Okay, we're beginning here, 12 lines down on the top of Tzadi Tet Amud Aleph. We left off yesterday with a statement by Rav Asi, who says, Lo Shanu, that in our Mishnah, when it says that the Uman, the craftsman, is responsible for the damage he does, that's only true when he was given a finished product, and then he damages that finished product. On the other hand, if he was given more materials, and then created a finished product, and then damaged that finished product, there he's not liable because the increased value from the raw materials to the finished product was all his doing. So when he damages the item, he's damaging his own handiwork. He's not really hurting the Baalim because they were going to pay him for that handiwork. Now they won't pay him for that handiwork, but he's not responsible for the damage that is done to the item in that case. All right, so then we had the Shita of Shmuel, which seemingly disagreed with Rav Asi. The Gemara concluded that even though Shmuel is presenting a position that might oppose that of Rav Asi, he's only doing it to show that the Mishnah is not necessarily a proof to Rav Asi's position. That doesn't mean that he himself actually subscribes to that position. So now the Gemara moves on to another proof, which is Tashma. Hanotein talito l'uman, person who gives his cloak to a craftsman, gamro, he finished the work, vehodio, and he lets him know, afilu mikan vadasara yamim, if he lets him know and he's done the work, even if he informs him from now until 10 days, you're not in violation of lotalin. Lotalin is a restriction. It's one of two restrictions that involve the payment of what's called schire yom, day laborers. One is lotalin plat schire itcha at the boker. And then there is beyomoti ten scharo, which is to pay him on the day that he does his work. The Torah requires that when the Schir Yom finishes his labor, that you pay him immediately, which means in the time frame in which he finishes, that you have the remainder of that time frame to come in windows of 12 hours, day and night. If he finishes during the day, you have the remainder of the day to pay him. If he finishes during the night, you have the remainder of the night to pay him. But the obligation is to pay him immediately. Now here, this individual finishes the work. He's not in violation of Lo Talin when he informs him about the fact that it's finished. Natnalo b'chatzi ayom, if he handed him the object during halfway through the day, kevin sheshakala b'chama, as soon as the sun sets, over ala mishum baltalin, then he is obligated to pay. If he doesn't pay by the end of that day, then he's in violation of baltalin. So here the Braita differentiates between a case where he informs you that the work is done versus a case where he hands you the finished product. He just informs you that the work is done. That does not start the clock ticking for the obligation to pay the schir yom, to pay the day laborer. The other hand, when he hands the finished product, when he hands the item back to the owner, that starts the clock and you have to pay within that 12-hour frame, meaning whether if it was in the day, by the end of that day, if it's in the night, by the end of that night, you must pay for the wages that he has earned. Now the Gemara says, based on the statement here in this Braita, now you see that an Uman has a din of a Schir Yom and not a din of a Kablan. And that is, V'isak adatcha Uman kone b'shevach kli. If you think that the way that the Uman gets paid is not for his labor, but rather he is selling the appreciated item back to the owner. Owner hands him raw materials. He crafts whatever it is that he is supposed to do. Then he gives it to the owner. There are two ways to view the possibility of his payment over here. Either he was, quote-unquote, a day laborer, and you're paying him literally for the labor. So you're paying him for whatever hours or whatever labor he put in. That's how you're paying him. Or do we say that the finished product becomes the possession of the Uman? He is koneh. He acquires it through the craftsmanship, the work that he has done. And now there is a sale of a material in order to realize the work that he did here. He's not asking for payment for the labor, he's asking payment for the finished product. So are you selling labor, which would make him into a schir yom, or are you selling a product, would make him a merchant, or a kablan maybe, not a day laborer? From the Braita, from a description over here, where the obligation is to pay him when he gives it to you, on that day, that he's a schir yom, that shows that he's a laborer and not someone who is selling you an item to realize the value of his labor. So that shows you that an Uman is not kone in Shevach Kli, which is against the position of Rav Asi. Rav Asi said the difference between why someone who works on a finished product, meaning that he's putting in an extra nail, fixing a hinge, doing something with the finished product, why he's considered to be a Sekir Yom is because he's not kone in the Shevach Kli. He's being hired for the labor that he does. On the other hand, if he is given raw materials and forms it, the reason that he does not have to pay for damage done to the finished product he created is because the way he's going to realize his value is through the sale of the finished product back to the owner. That finished product in the interim belongs to the Uman. Or the terminology the Gemara uses is Uman kone b'shevach kli. That the Uman has rights in the appreciated value that he created in this item. From this right, it seems to be the opposite of that position of Rav Asi. Over here, the Uman cannot be kone b'shevach kli, otherwise there'd be no violation of lo talin. And so that's what the Gemara says, v'isach adatcha uman kone b'shevach kli, amai uver mishum bal talin. Why would you be in violation of bal talin, which is a restriction against withholding labor wages from the individual, from a sechir yom, not a restriction against payment for an item or an object where the person is selling you the item or the object. Because they're not a sechir yom, they are a merchant. In a sense, they are selling you an item. Amar Rav Mari Brei de Rav Gana, Begardo de Sarvela, de Leka Shvacha. It's a case of a Gardela de Sarvela, where there is no additional value or appreciation in the item itself. Generally, a Gardo is a weaver. De Sarvela seems to be that it's talking about something that is woolly or thick, but the main objective in this case of the professional is to soften clothing. Now, many times the clothing, you can know that today, hardens after it's washed. Meaning that when you launder the clothing and then you hang it out to dry, it becomes very hard or stiff. So I don't know if that's the result of that. They wanted it softened, or it was part of the laundering process itself, that they wanted the individual to soften it. The way that they softened it is by stomping on it, by standing on it, by pressing it with their feet. So this person hired this Garda de Sarvela in order to soften a beged. So that's what he says. There's no additional value embedded in the object. It says, the sof sof, the maya hava nihale, what was the reason that he gave it to him? Lirekuche, in order to soften it. Kevin de rakachache, hainu shvacha. Once he softens it, that is the additional value that is placed in the beged. So you're right. We're not talking about a craftsman in the sense of taking raw materials and then forming them into something more complex or something more valuable, but they still are an individual who has a specific purpose or a specific skill set, but he has a results-based payment, which is that we will pay you for softening the beged. And in doing so, once you have a softened beged, then the value of softening the beged is now embedded in that beged. So there is appreciation, not the classic sense of appreciation, but the change of the beged from being hardened to soft, that is a results-based operation in which you would pay for the result. And so therefore he should be, what they call it, a kablan, or he should be an uman, not a sechir yom. You're not paying for the labor, you're paying him for the resultant softened item. Same thing like dry cleaners. I mean, you take something to the launderer, that you expect them to clean the item and you're paying them to get a result of a clean item. You're not simply paying them to work a couple hours or work this much 15 minutes on the beged. You're paying them for the result. And that's the same thing over here. That's shevach in the kli. Lo, tzricha de agre le bitche. He hired him for the stomping. Bitcha, bitcha b'ma'ato. Each stomp, I'm going to pay you one ma'ah. So here you have, there's a fixed payment for the process or the engagement here. It's not a results-based payment. It's actually an activity-based payment, which is the equivalent. I want you to spend this much time on the object, or here, I want you to stomp this many times on the object, and every time you stomp on it, I'm going to pay you a certain amount of money. So here, the payment is not based on the results, but payment is based on the activity that the person is engaged in. The Gemara here says, "Dainu schirut," which is a laborer or paying for labor, not a kablan, or not someone where you're paying them for the results. So Rashi over here describes this betushe, says, hitna imo skum hadrichot. He tracked it with him for the number of stomps that he's going to do. Kol dricha b'ma'ah, each stomp will be worth a ma'ah. D'schir hu'omo v'lo kablan. That makes him into a day laborer and not a contractor. Contractors are hired to finish a job or to get to a certain outcome. A schir yom is paid for the activity that they engage in, the number of times, the number of hours, whatever it is that they're hired to do, not for necessarily the results that or the finished product that you get. Now, Tosfot over here says that the Rashi's definition over here is not necessarily clear. And he says that Rashi explains that he's not a kablan, but he is a schirua. Tema. Ma ratzino lomar, di makom makom, ari kablanu, below schir yom. That even if you say the way that Rashi is stating it, he still is a kablan and not a schir yom. Tosafot over here favors Rashi's interpretation in Baba Metzia, where he says, Persha binyan acher, de agre le biche, kishaba le beta gardi, but shimber aglaim etoch kliyamayim. That when you come to the, call it the dry cleaners, you come into the koveis, they stomp on the clothing. Meleo lo bikabalanuta skinen el bischirut, ben yeshbiach, ben lo yeshbiach. Doesn't matter whether you improve the situation or not. Skaro lefi minyana bitishult. It all has to do with the number of stomps that you do. So what changes you from a kablan to a schir yom is whether the result matters. And so that's what Tosafot makes clear here, that Rashi says that he wants him to stomp a certain number of times, get softer. So even in the end, if you can't call that guy a schir yom because you want a result and you're still expecting a certain result, you're paying him for the number of stomps, but he's going to stomp until it's soft. Once you do that, he becomes a kablan and not a schir yom, because you still expect a result from him. By expecting a result from him, that makes him into a kablan and not a schir yom. So what Tosafot says is that the structure of the relationship has to be, you stomp 100 times on the beged, no matter what the outcome is after that 100 times, I'm paying you for the 100 stomps. So once you take away the result, then already you become a schir yom, because you're hiring him specifically for the process and not for the outcome. So it's nuanced, but Rashi, who says that he's still working towards a specific result, even if he's paying him per stomp, that still doesn't make him into a schir yom, that still makes him a kablan. You have to eliminate the outcome side of this and just say that it's a fixed number of stomps, then he becomes a schir yom. So Gemara says, okay, lamai desalik adatin mikara, delo agre de biche. So the fact that up front we thought that he was not hired for stomping, misayile the Rav Sheshet. That helps Rav Sheshet. So before we thought he was a kablan, now we think that he is a schir yom. But that means in our original assessment, when we thought he was a kablan, that means that we believed over there that there is a din of baal talin by a kablan. Which is the question that was posed to Rav Sheshet, the bai minei Rav Sheshet, kablanut, over alav mishum baal talin, oveno over alav, are you liable for withholding the wages of a kablan or not? Vamarlo Rav Sheshet, over, you are in violation. Now the violation here will be different. Again, by the schir yom, every day that he finishes his work, then he's entitled to payment. And the withholding of that payment is a violation. On the other hand, for the kablan, it's not going to work that way. The kablan is paid based on results. So then the clock or the trigger will only happen once he's finished whatever was the result that he was hired to produce. Then that will start the clock ticking. So unlike a schir yom where it's daily or whatever, nightly, depending on when he's working, that the obligation comes about as soon as he's finished those hours, a kablan will only trigger that once he's finished whatever he's undertaken to do. But he still, once he has done that and delivered the goods, then you will have a clock ticking and there is a violation of baal talin. And that's what Rav Sheshet said. And the Gemara says that our havamina, that we were speaking about a kablan and not a schir yom, shows you that the Gemara felt comfortable, or the Braita would have been comfortable with the fact that if he was a kablan, you would be in violation of baal talin. And that's supportive of Rav Sheshet's view that a kablan also has a din of baal talin, not just the schir yom. All right, Gemara says, Lema de Rav Sheshet, Pliga de Rav Asi. Let us say that Rav Sheshet's position now is contrary to that of Rav Asi, because Rav Sheshet, who was asked about kablanut, says kablanut is subject to baal talin. That means that he views kablanut as being payment for labor and not payment for the product that was created. Again, the same distinction we drew above in the Braita, that if you're paid for labor, then you could be in violation of Baal Talin. If you're paid for the finished product, meaning your labor is embedded in the value created in this product, you're selling a product, then you can't be in violation of Baal Talin. Rav Asi says, Uman kone b'shevach kli, which means that the Uman's labor is now embedded in the value of the item, he's selling the item to the person who commissioned him. On the other hand, Rav Sheshet is saying that a Kablan, at the end of their work, basically starts a clock and says, now you owe me for my labor. Once you do that, it means that Uman is not kone b'shevach kli, or that they're arguing, Rav Sheshet and Rav Asi. That's what the Gemara is asking now. It seems like Rav Sheshet disagrees with Rav Asi. So, Amar Shmuel Baracha b'shlicha digarto. That Rav Sheshet's question or case was a case of a delivery person, a mail carrier. So that person who is hired, even as a kablan, does not create shevach kli. Unlike the case where we said where you're softening the beged, where there is a result in the object itself, there you could argue that there's still shevach mekli. There's still additional value created when you soften it. For a mail carrier, for a delivery individual, they do nothing to the object itself. Their whole value is in the activity that they're engaged in, which is the delivering of the object. You can't claim that there's uman kone b'shevach kli there because there's no change in the kli. That none of his work affects the kli itself. His whole objective or his whole labor is to bring the item from one place to another place. And so that case, Rav Sheshet says, you can be in violation of Baal Talin, but that wouldn't argue on Rav Asi necessarily because in that situation, there is no shevach kli for the uman to be kone b'shevach kli, and therefore the mail carrier is hired as a kablan, a results-based payment, is still considered to be collecting on his labor and not on his outcome because that's all he can collect on. The outcome has no impact on the kli. He can't be selling you the letter when he gets to the other location. He simply is charging you for the labor or that which he undertook to get there. And so therefore you could explain Rav Sheshet as being a case where it does not argue on Rav Asi because the case does not involve shevach kli. Since it doesn't involve shevach kli, it's not necessarily an argument on Rav Asi. So lema kitanaye. Let us say that Rav Asi's position about kone b'shevach kli is a machloket tanaim. Aseli shiraim nizamim v'tabot ve'akadesh lecha. The woman says to the man is a jeweler, and she basically hands him raw materials, metals of some sort, and says, I want you to form them into earrings, nose rings, rings. I want you to make me some jewelry here. And with that jewelry, I will get married to you. So the uman, the craftsman over here, is adding value. That added value is what is the consideration for the marriage. She hands him raw materials. That certainly can't be the consideration for the marriage because the man must give the woman something. The only thing the man is giving the woman over here is the value that he creates by changing the metal into a finished product, into jewelry. Kevan shasan mikudeshet, divrei Rabbi Meir. Once they are completed, Rabbi Meir says the kiddushin go effective immediately. Chamim omrim eina mikudeshet, achigia mamon liyada. That she is not married until the money reaches her hands. My mamon. What money are we speaking about here? Ilema oto mamon. If we're talking about the object itself, Michlal de Rabbi Meir Savar, oto mamon, lo. So you're suggesting here that Rabbi Meir would believe that that money does not work?
So if the return of the finished product is what generates the kiddushin according to the Chachamim, then Rabbi Meir doesn't believe that you need to return the object in order to generate the kiddushin. If that's the case, by what consideration are you generating the kiddushin over here? It would seem that even according to Rabbi Meir, you have to get the object back to the woman in order to generate the kiddushin. And in a second, Tosfos will explain why you actually need the object to go back and you can't create other intangible consideration which would complete the kiddushin over here.
That means that Rabbi Meir thinks that that doesn't work as kiddushin. Then what is he getting engaged to her with? I mean, it's clear here that the value that he creates, or the schar, the payment for his wages, is what he is getting engaged to her with, is what he is using to generate the kiddushin over here. So if the chachamim say the mamon is the wages owed, then Rabbi Meir is going to argue on that. Of course, that's the only monies that exchanged hands here, or the only consideration that he has created. So then, of course, Rabbi Meir would agree that that's the mechanism for him getting married. The wage is the only thing that could be the consideration over here. Now, what you could suggest is, the forgiveness of the wages is what generates the consideration. Here he did the work for her, and then he says he waives the collection of that money. So the waiving of the collection of that money is giving her value, and so then maybe that's how you do it. Tosafot says over here, Omri, the Svaru she'im mikudesh v'meh she'mochel la'scharo. The fact that he forgives the wages certainly cannot be the consideration over here. Afilu lo yeh uman koneh b'shevach li. Even if the uman does not acquire value inside the kli itself. Ela milva yesh lo aleh, v'hu mochel la. Because the only thing that happened here is that she owes him money. Owing him money is a loan. A loan that is forgiven, ena mikudeshet. Because the woman has no intent to get married with the forgiveness in the loan. Until she gets the actual physical products back. She's not going to marry him simply by the forgiveness of his labor or the loan, basically, that he extended to her by not charging her the labor now. That consideration is not enough. She has expectations of getting the jewelry back. Until she gets the jewelry back, she's not going to acquiesce simply by the forgiveness of the money owed for the labor, get married to him on that until she gets the finished product back. Va'od omeri. Even if both parties want that to be the kiddushin, it doesn't work. Even though she is obligated to pay him as it goes along, because wages are earned over the period of time. Since he cannot demand payment for his wages until the final product is handed to her, then he's not giving her anything until he can take her to court and demand payment. So that means that your payment is given or earned over the period of time that you do the work. Even so, when you forgive the wages, you haven't forgiven anything because it hasn't become a monetary obligation yet. The monetary obligation only happens when he hands the objects back to the woman. So until he hands the objects back to the woman, there's no obligation. Once the obligation is created, then you could talk about maybe the forgiveness of a loan being consideration for the kiddushin. That will have to do with mekadesh b'milveh and a machloket mishonin that we saw in kiddushin about whether forgiveness of loans is sufficient consideration to generate kiddushin. But what's clear here is without the return of the objects, there's no way that you could say that the forgiveness is sufficient consideration. And so that's why Tosafot says, the Gemara doesn't suggest that Rabbi Meir is saying that he simply forgave the wages. Because according to Rabbi Meir in this situation, he says when you finish the work, the kiddushin go effective. There was no giving of the objects to the woman. So if that's the case, forgiveness of the loan or the salary cannot be the consideration here for the kiddushin. Ella pshita. My mamon, what is the money that's exchanged here? Mamon acher, some other money that is being exchanged. Visavrua, this is what we're going to assume. So now the Gemara is going to put down assumptions and then create the machloket over here. By putting down assumptions, you know how the Gemara can get out of the problem, which is simply undermining the assumptions and saying that they're arguing about the assumption itself. So you already, the Gemara is giving you the way out, but it's making a statement at first. Visavrua, dekuli alma yesh l'schirut mitchila v'ad sof. Everybody agrees that wages are earned over the entirety of the period. There are two opinions with regards to this. One is that ain't schirut ela basof, that the rental income, the labor income is only earned at the last moment when you've completed what you're supposed to do. The other opinion, which is what the Gemara is assuming here, is that you're earned or it accrues over the period of time. If you get married with a loan, it does not work. My love. So what is the machloket between them? They're arguing about whether the labor of the craftsman is embedded in the object itself. The Rabbi Meir Savar, Uman Koneh B'Shevach Kli. The Uman is Koneh B'Shevach Kli. Therefore, he has created value in the object itself. That value is now embedded in the object. And using that object, meaning now giving the object to her, you've generated consideration that goes. The Rabbanan Savre, Ein Uman Koneh B'Shevach Kli. Therefore, the wages cannot be the consideration over here because the wages are a loan. He was earning them over the period of time, and as he waits to get paid, he has now generated a loan to her. When she pays him for that consideration, that is a payment or repayment of a loan. A repayment of a loan cannot be the consideration for the marriage. Ela mamon acher. You have to add in additional money to be the consideration over here. And that's what the chachamim mean, that once he pays mamon, that's when the marriage takes effect. You have to create a different consideration, which is independent of what is going over here. So Gemara says, so now what we're suggesting is this idea of uman koneh b'shev kli is the machlokah between Rabbi Meir and the chachamim. Gemara says, lo, dekuli ama ain uman koneh b'shev kli. No, everybody could agree that an uman is not koneh b'shev kli. Elohacha, b'yeshna s'chirut mitchilev atzov kamiflegei. So the Gemara says, well, you could just argue about the first assumption we made. The first assumption we made is that everybody agrees that earnings happen over a time, not at the moment of completion. Well, then they could argue about that. Rabbi Meir savar in schirut ela b'sof. So for Rabbi Meir, there's no schirut until the last moment. Since there's no schirut until the last moment, there's no loan outstanding here. He's marrying her with that payment that was due at the moment he finished. That's something that is extant now. That wasn't something that was generated in the past. Rabbanan savar yesh v'schirut mitchila b'sof, and therefore there's a loan here. If you're mekadesh v'milva, in a mekudeshet. So if you're trying to get married with that loan that was extended, you can't do that. The money was already given out. The payments were already made to the woman by the fact that he lent it out. Now, after the fact, you're trying to marry with something that already was done? You can't do that after the fact. So the Chamim would say, no marriage here because you're mekadesh v'milveh. Rabbi Meir says there is a marriage because there's no milveh. It was only earned at the last moment. At that moment, you're asking for the kiddushin. That's fine because that money is now being given to her at that moment. The other possibility is that we agree with our original assumption that everybody thinks that tchila ad sof, schirut is earned over the period of time, and therefore it is a milveh. And their argument is about whether you can get married with a loan. So Rameir Savar, mekadesh memilveh mikudeshet. Someone gets married with a loan is married. Rabbanan Savar, mekadesh memilveh eino mikudeshet. That the one who gets married through a loan is not married. So you can create the machloka between them along any one of these assumptions. It does not have to be umman koneh b'shev kli as the basis for their machloket. Rabba Amar, Rabba says no. The kuli ama yesh l'skirut mitchila v'atzof. The kuli ama mekadesh mevil v'einu mikudeshet. So here Rabba says we're going to go with our original assumptions. The fact that skirut is earned over the whole period of time. That your wages are earned not at the moment when you finish, but rather over the whole period of the labor. And number two is, in Mekadesh Milveh, if you try to get married with a loan, it doesn't work. So now we're back to what is the machlok between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim. Before we suggested it was Uman Koneh B'Shlev Echli. But he says now, the Ukuli Alma ain't Uman Koneh B'Shlev Echli. Everybody agrees that Uman is not Koneh in Shlev Echli, meaning that the Uman's labor is not embedded inside the item itself. Elohachem Ma'eskinan, what's the machlok here? Kagon Shehosif La Nofech Mishalo. He added on one more little jewel or precious stone of his own. So in excess of what she asked for, he now adds something of his own volition. Nofech is mentioned in the Torah with regards to the Choshen, Nofech Sapir V'Yahalom, it's one of the stones that's mentioned there. So he puts a precious stone in there that was not part of their agreement. So now he has added on something which is a machloket about, Rabbi Meir Savar, Milve Upruta. If you're trying to marry with a loan, plus a pruta, data pruta. The woman's mind is on the pruta itself, and therefore the marriage goes through. Rabbanan save milve pruta data milve. That if you marry with a loan and a pruta, the woman's focus is on the milve, on the loan, and for that reason, you don't get married because that's mikadesh b'milve. The pruta doesn't change that. And that'll be their machloket as to whether the addition of the pruta changes the fact that this is a mikadesh b'milve. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, when it talks about Megadish Memilveh Bepruta, speaks about the case of David HaMelech, when he tried to marry Merav, the daughter of Shaul, that the condition for the marriage was that he bring back the Orlot of the Plishtim. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says the machlok between David and Shaul, as to whether he was married to Merav or not, revolved around that issue. As to whether he was Megadish Memilveh Bepruta, is that considered to be Kiddushin or not? And the question was whether the orlot that he brought were shave pruta, and based on that, whether it was mekadesh b'milveh pruta, and that was the machlok between him and Shaul. Uplokta dehani tanei, and similar to another machlok tanei that we saw, the tanya b'schar shesiti imach ena mekudeshet. If the guy says to her, I want to marry you with the work that I've already done for you, it doesn't work. Because the work he's already done for her is now money that is owed, or in essence is a loan outstanding to the woman. He can't marry with that. With the wages that I will earn in the future for doing this for you, mikudeshet. That does work. Because over there, you're talking about future wages. That means that it's consideration that will come. There you can get married. When you do it in the future, meaning that with my wages in the future, that won't work. And certainly with wages from the past, that you can't use for kiddushin. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, here's the third opinion. Omer be'emet amru, ben b'schar she'asiti imach. Ben b'schar she'ase imach, ena mikudeshet, similar to Rabbi Natan, that neither of those work. V'im hosifla nofech mishelo, if he adds on a precious stone of his own, mikudeshet. So now you have a three-way machloket over here, and the Gemara explains the differences in their opinions. Ben tanakama the Rabbi Natan, ike be'inayu, what is the machloket between Rabbi Natan and Tanakama? Bikabanayu, schirut. That is, the labor is the difference between them. Meaning, whether schirut is over the whole period of time, or schirut besof, that is the machloket between them. The one who says that ain't schirut ela besof, the Tanakama's view that you can use your future wages as a vehicle for consideration to create kiddushin, is because he believes you only earn your wages at the last moment. Since you only earn your wages at the last moment, at that moment, that's when you're giving her the money, and you're giving them money at that time. You're saying, we're going to generate kiddushin through that money, through the wages that you now owe me, because I'm giving you to that now, and it's a single moment when you're getting married, and that the wages are being given to her, meaning that she owes that money, and now she no longer has to pay it. The other hand, Rabbi Natan believes, Yeshus Chirot mitchila v'atsof, that the wages are earned over the period of time. And the problem is now when he finishes the work and she owes him the wages, that even if you believe that the wages are earned over time, you still don't pay until the end. If you don't pay until the end, everything is a loan all the way along. That means at the moment that he wants to marry her, when the work is complete and she owes the wages, it's mikadosh b'milvin, it doesn't work. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi agrees with Rabbi Natan, but then adds on an additional item, which is ben Rabbi Natan, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, ike benau milveo pruta. The difference between them is whether adding on an additional pruta will help you. According to Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, the additional pruta makes it that you are mekadesh with the pruta, not the milveh. For Rabbi Natan, once it's a milveh, doesn't matter if you add on a pruta, it's not going to help you. And that's the three-way machloket that we have over here. So by doing that, we create a situation in which they don't necessarily argue. There's not a machloket tanaim about Ravasi's position about whether Uman is kone b'shevakli. Even though the Gemara here set up the cases as being machlokot that revolve around an assumption of ein Uman kone b'shevakli. That the Uman is not Koneh B'Shevachli, which means that everybody holds that, which would be against Rabasi as well. Meaning that even though we've created a situation or a circumstance in which they're not arguing about the issue of Rabasi, but by making those assumptions of Ein Uman Koneh B'Shevachli in the assumptions, that shows you that they all agree to that point. Now, the Gemara showed you that they could argue about different matters besides Shevachli, so therefore it's not conclusive over here. But the fact that the Gemara twice sets up the case where Kuliyama ain't Oman Kuneh B'Shevachli, that the Uman is not Kuneh B'Shevachli, seems to indicate that they're favoring a position against Ravasi over here. Now the Gemara moves on to another issue. Amar Shmuel, Tabach Uman Shekil Kel. You have an expert butcher who messed up the Shechita. He did a Shechita improperly, he made the animal into a Nevela. Chayav L'Shalem. He has to pay. Maziku. He is a damager. Posheyo, he is negligent. Nase ke'omer lo, shchot li mikan. It's as if someone said to him, shecht me this over here. V'shachat lo mikan. And he instead shecht it in a different location. Lama le lemeimar, why do you have to call him both a maziku, posheyo? Why do you have to call him both a mazik and a posheyo? Because iamar maziku, because had you said he was a damager, that's only true. He's called a mazik when he's getting paid to do this. Here where he's doing it for free, lo, maybe he would not be responsible as a mazik. From here, Tosafot says over here, even though Adam is mu'ad olam, and by onus, he should be chayav, irrespective of whether he's getting paid or it's free. So what you see from here, Tosafot concludes is, Ones ki hai lo mechayev adam mazik. A person like this type of ones would not be held liable. So there are unsim where Adam Muad Olam does not apply. And that's what Tosfot says. The Gemara is indicating to you that not all unsim are created equal. And therefore, sometimes the ones is enough to obligate you or make you liable. Sometimes it's not enough, even though Adam is Muad Olam should obligate him in all circumstances. Nevertheless, there are instances where you can get an exemption or you are freed of that liability. That's what you see from here. So Kamash Malan Posheo, that's why we term him as also a Posheya, as someone who is negligent. So in cases where as a Mazik he would not be Chayav, we make him negligent and call him a Posheya, which makes him Chayav, because as a Posheya you're going to be Chayav as a Shomer, or for misappropriating, misusing, or mistreating the item. So therefore you'll be Chayav either as a Mazik or as a Posheya, and that'll cover all instances of his engagement. So Eitvei Rav Chama Bar Gurya L'Shmuel. Hanotein Be'ema L'Tabach V'Nivla. Person hands over an animal to the butcher and he causes it to become an Avela. Uman Patur Hejot Chayav. If he's an expert Shochet, he is Patur. He basically gets an indemnity because of the fact that he is an expert. I mean, that gives him protection. Hejot, if he is a layperson, which means that he shouldn't be involved in Shechita, then he's Chayav because he misrepresented what his skill set was, and in a sense, he's a Posheya. V'im notein schar, if he pays for whatever is done here, ben hejot, ben uman chayav. Whether it's a layperson or an expert, you are chayav. So the expert only earns the indemnification if he does it gratis, if he does it for free. But if he's getting paid for it, that makes him liable for whatever happens here. So this would be a challenge to Shmuel's statement, because Shmuel's statement before was that tabach uman, that is mikalkel, is the chayav l'shalem. He has to pay for everything. So over there we made no distinction between whether there was sachar or there was no sachar. Shmuel makes a blanket statement that the uman is always responsible if he makes the animal into a nevela. Yet, what we're questioning here is that we have a braita that seems to indicate that a tabach is only liable if he was getting paid for it. If he wasn't getting paid for it, he would not be liable. And that would be a question on Shmuel's position. Amalei La'aker mochech. The word la'aker means to muddy or to cloud. Mochech would be your head, your brain. So from the way that we have it written in our Gemara, that was like a klala, which is your head should be clouded or your head should be unclear. The other way to say it is if the words were reversed, it would be mochech akur, that your mind is unclear or you don't have a clear thought process. That'd be easier to understand over here, which is that he's saying to him, you don't really understand what you're saying. You don't really understand the nature of your question. On the other hand, here Shmuel is otherwise saying something much more harsh to him, which is saying that your head should become cloudy because you're asking these clouded questions. You're asking a question that's not right. So Adum Elmi Rabbanan Kamoti Play. So another Rabbanan came and asked Shmuel the same question. Amalei Hashta Shakalt by the Shakal Chaverch. But now you're going to get the same thing that your friend got, which means that either if you say that it's a curse, that you'll get the same curse he got because you're asking me the same question. Or if you say that your thought process is unclear, you're getting the same thing your friend gets, which is your thought process is unclear over here. Kamina luchu ana Rabbi Meir. I am speaking about the position of Rabbi Meir. V'kamaratuli Rabbanan. And you're responding to me the shita of the Rabbanan. Meaning Shmuel says, my opinion is premised on Rabbi Meir's shita, and therefore I say uman is chayav no matter what. You are quoting me a bright that is the shita of the Chachamim, who says there's a difference between getting paid and not getting paid. That's the shita of the Chachamim. That has nothing to do with me. Amai lo dayak t'mile. Why weren't you careful about the wording? Sha'ani omer maziku posheyahu. The reason that he's chayav over here is because he's a mazik and a posheya. Nase ki omer lo. It's as if he said to him, shchot imikan v'shachat omikan. Man itle haisvoro. Who has that logic? Rabbi Meir, the Amar Mibayle, the Mirmei Anafshe. He should have considered the possibility. He should have been aware of the possible outcomes. So Rabbi Meir is the one who has this opinion that you become a Posheya because you should have foreseen the possibilities of something going wrong over here. And if it goes wrong, then you are responsible as a Posheya. So that is Rabbi Meir's Shita. And Rabbi Meir is whom I'm speaking about. You're asking me a question from a Braita that differentiates between getting paid and not getting paid? That's the Shita of the Chachamim. And therefore, it's not a question on me. It's not a stira to what I said before. So now, for Rabbi Meir, it's irrespective of whether you're getting paid or not. It's the fact that you should have foreseen a possible problem here that you are obligated or that you are liable. Since you didn't foresee it and you didn't take care of the problem, meaning that you made a mistake, you're going to be liable for it. According to the Chachamim, you're only chayav when you're paid. The reason being is that once you're paid, you become a mazik if you do damage here. If you're a mazik, then you're chayav ba'onsin. Because Adam mu'ad de'olam, ben mishogeg ben mimizid. Because of the schar that you received. And he should have been aware, he should have at least considered the fact that the animal might have moved over here or might have changed over here. On the other hand, if you do a numan who doesn't get paid for it, then he is patur because it's onsin. So that's the way that the Rabbanon view it. Rabbi Meir says you're chayav no matter what. So Mara wants to know, hey Rabbi Meir, which Rabbi Meir has this logic? Ilema ha Rabbi Meir, you think it's this Rabbi Meir? So it's not, the beginning of a Perek HaKones. Kashru ba'ala b'mosera, the owners tied it up with a leash, b'nal b'fanav k'rayu, and they locked the doors to withstand normal wind situations. B'yatzav ezik, and the animal goes out then and damages, ben tam ben muad chayav. Whether it is a tame animal, a white animal, you're going to be chayav, divrei Rabbi Meir. So Rabbi Meir over there says you're chayav, even though it seemingly you took care of it, you locked it up properly, and it's an ones over there, you're still held liable because you are a shomer, you're an expert getting paid for your job. Mar says, no, that's not the proof. Hotam, pikrai plige. Over there, that's a machloket in the psukim. Over there, as we've learned, that Rabbi Meir believes that psukim tell us that a shmira pchuta, or a normal type of shmira, is insufficient when it comes to a shor. The Torah demands a shmira mi'ula, a super shmira. And unless you do that super shmira, you're going to be liable. But that's a unique circumstance associated with shor tam and shor muad. Rabbi Yehuda there argues on him and says that a shor tam, you need a shmira mi'ula like Rabbi Meir. A shor muad, you only need a shmira pchuta. And again, that's a machloket in how to interpret the psukim between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir. So that doesn't tell you generically about Rabbi Meir's shita. It's uniquely associated with the psukim by Shor Tam and Shor Muad. So that can't be the source for this position of Shmuel. Elaha, Rabbi Meir. Maybe it's this Rabbi Meir, it's none. The Mishnah, Zboa lo Adom, Mitzvah Shachor. He gave it to the dyer in order to make it red, and he made it black. Shachor, he gave it to him to make it black, but Zboa Adom. And he made it red. Rabbi Meir Omer, notain lo dmei tamro. You have to give him back the value of the wool. So there you see that even though it was accidental, it was bishogeg, since he is an uman, he's held accountable for it. So you see this idea that even when you're an uman, as soon as you become an uman, you are responsible for whatever damage or whatever happens to the object or the item. Mar says, hatam biyadayim kalo omine. Over there, he actively destroyed or changed the object. I mean that when you're dying it, you're actively involved, you're hands-on involved with it. So it's actually like a mazik biyadayim. So even though it was unintentional, it was shogeg, nevertheless, because he was engaged directly with it, as Rashi says over here, shnitkavein lishnanot, that he intended to change it. I mean that he intends to make it into black, or he intends to make it into red. He's doing whatever the problem is. So even though he wasn't trying necessarily to make it red instead of black, or black instead of red, but when he made it red, that was his intent, to make it red. When he made it black, his intent was to make it black. Not in this case. In this case, the Uman is trying to shecht it properly. What ended up happening is something that he did not intend for. So maybe over there it would be different. Ella, ha, Rabbi Meir. It's this Rabbi Meir. It's none. Nishbara Kadov, this is back from Perek HaMeniach, that if his pitcher breaks, the lo silka, and he doesn't remove the shards from the shutarbim, nafla gimalo, if his gamal fell over or tripped, velo hemidan, he doesn't upright it, Rabbi Meir Omer, chayav beniskan, you are chayav for any damage that they cause. V'chachamim omrim, patur midinei adam, v'chayav midinei shamayim. We say he's patur midinei adam, because we're going to say nitkal is onesu, tripping is an accident. Now, he should have cleaned up afterwards. He should try to take away these objects from the shutarabim. But since it's a nitkal onesu, since it's an accident when you trip, he gets this ptur, he gets this exemption afterwards. On the other hand, Rabbi Meir believes nitkal posheyahu, that a nitkal is negligent. Since he was negligent when he fell over and the items broke and spread their shards or the gamal was laying on the ground, he's now obligated to remove the quote-unquote negligence that he created over here. And so therefore it says, and that's what they're arguing about. So you see here that Rabbi Meir believes, even though something accidental happens over here, we might have expectations of you to act in a certain manner. And since you did not live up to those expectations, you're considered to be a posheya. So whether it's the fact that you tripped, you're considered to be a posheya because we don't expect you to trip. We expect you to walk normally and not trip up, and you become a posheya. A tabach uman, if you are an expert shechter, then we expect that your shechita will be done properly. If it's done improperly, you become a posheya. Similar to when you trip, even though the tripping is quote-unquote accidental, you're considered to be a posheya because you should have foreseen that. You should have prevented that from happening. Similar over here. You should have foreseen that the animal might move. You should have prevented the fact that there would be a nevela over here. And therefore, if you create the nevela, you're deemed to be a posheya. And this is the Rabbi Meir that Shmuel is commenting on or extrapolating to our case over here to say an uman tabach is chayav if he makes a nevela. So Amar Rabbi Barchan, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Tabach uman shekilkel chayav. So now you have Rabbi Barchan saying the name of Rabbi Yochanan, similar to Shmuel, that an expert tabach, an expert butcher, that has a problem in the shechita. Not that he did a shechita and the animal's found to be a treifa. That's a treifa. Here we're talking about a nevela. Kilkel means that there was some problem in the shechita itself that makes it into a nevela. Chayav. Vafilu hu man kitabachei tzipori. Even if he's on the level of the greatest experts of butchers, like the butchers of Tzipori, Tzipori being a big city, and the butchers there being expert or well-seasoned butchers, and nevertheless, you're still chayav. So that's supportive of what Shmuel said before. Rabbi Yochanan Ochi, Rabbi Yochanan really said this. There was an incident that came before Rabbi Yochanan in the Beit Knesset of Ma'on, which is a city that's near Tiberia. So you're talking about all around cities that are near each other. Tzipori, Ma'on, Tiberia. These are all cities that are up in the Galil, in a small region up in that area where these cities exist, where Rabbi Yochanan was living. So he says, listen, if you go bring me proof that you're licensed to shecht birds, then I will exempt you, I will indemnify you because you're an expert butcher over here. So we see from Rabbi Yochanan's statement, if he can provide credentials that he is a proper shochet, then he doesn't have to pay if he made a mistake. That goes against what we just saw from Rabbi Yochanan, that the expert butcher is always on the hook. Over here, it sounds like he can get out of the problem if he shows that he has credentials to shecht a tarnagol. Lokasha, kan bechinam, kan beschar. Depends on whether he's getting paid or not getting paid. If he's getting paid, then his liability rises, and then he's on the hook for no matter what happens there. If he's doing it for free, then his liability is only if he's not an expert. If he's an expert, then he's indemnified because he's not getting paid for it. It does not make him into a posheya in that case. So it says, Gadar Rabbi Zera, and this is where Rabbi Zera advises, Harotzeshit chayev lo tabach, yaktim lo dinar. If you want the tabach to be on the hook for shechting the animal, prepay him a portion of the money. Once you've prepaid him a portion of the money, then there's a kinyan here in the item. And once there's a kinyan in the item, makes a mistake and he ruins the shechita, he's going to be responsible because now he is in a sense, shomer sachar, or he's a person who's being hired or paid to do this, and he will be liable. On the other hand, if you don't pay him, then he is, in essence, working for free and selling you the meat afterwards. If that's the case, if something goes wrong with the shechita, he will not be held liable. So the one way to do it is to go make a kinyan on the item itself, but that's hard sometimes. So the easier way to do it is just to prepay him a portion of the money. That prepayment gets you ownership or sufficient kinyan here, where it's going to make him responsible for the shechita. And that's what you're trying to do over here. That's what you're trying to create over here. All right, so now Gemara says, Meitave, Hamochlich chitim. Now, you can read this one of two ways. You can be Molich chitim litchon. He's taking the wheat to be milled. Or the way Rashi reads it, Adam amuneh kach. This is the person who mills. You're taking the wheat to the miller. And then that is, when, instead of being litchon, would be litachon, to someone who mills. So depending on how you pronounce the word, would make a difference here. If you say it's litchon, means that you're taking it to be milled. If you're saying it's litachon, means you're taking it to the miller. Velo latatan. He did not first wet them or soak them, basan subim or mursan. And because of that, he made them into bran. So normally what they did in the milling process was that they washed the kernels, they wet them or soak them so that the kernels would loosen or either float off or come off. And then they would send them through a light milling, which would simply remove the klipa but leave the kernel intact. After they dried then afterwards and the klipot were off, the husks were off, then they would mill it completely to get into a white flour. If you mill it with the husks still on, you get the equivalent of whole wheat, or you get bran that comes out from that. So this individual who was the miller, or he was taken to be milled, and the person doing the job didn't properly wash them or soak them up front, and therefore when he milled it, he ended up with mursan or subin, which are different finenesses of bran that you can get. But he ended up not with the end product that the person had wanted or hired him for. Kemach lenachtom, he adds flour to the baker. Basau pat nipolin, and he makes them bread that is falling. But what in essence is, it's bread that didn't rise properly. It collapsed on itself. It's usually harder bread because it collapsed on itself. It doesn't have that airiness to it, that lightness to it. As well as the fact that Rashi says that it cracks or breaks because it's more called brittle or hard. So therefore it cracks and makes crumbs. Be'imala tabach, he gave an animal over to a butcher, v'nivla, and he made it into a nevela and his shchita. Chayav, he is chayav mipnei shehu kinosei sachar. He is chayav because he is like a nosei sachar. When you say like a nosei sachar, it means that he is not a nosei sachar. He's not getting paid, but he is like he's getting paid. So even though he's doing it for free, he is treated as if he was paid, and that means that he is liable because he's kin nosei sachar. He's like someone who gets paid. When you're like someone who gets paid, that means that you're not getting paid. You're just like someone who's getting paid. So you see over here, even when you don't get paid, you are still liable for the mistakes that you made. Where it says, Eima b'pnei shehu nosei sachar. Emend the brayta to say not that he's like someone who's getting paid, but rather he is someone who's getting paid, and that's why he's liable. How am I a grumuta, the atayah the kamedrav? There was a case of a problematic shchita. The laws of shchita are brought up in Chulin. One of the psulot, one of the five psulot, things that can be posel in shchita, is hagrama. Hagrama means moving in the shchita from the location in which you started the shchita to a different location, or basically outside the tabat. The tabat are the rings of the trachea. There are rings that move up all the way up the trachea until you reach what's called the tabat agdola, which is the large ring of the trachea, or the Adam's apple, the largest part of it. And the person was shochet in that area and then moved outside of that item. There are two possibilities of hagrama. Again, it's really much more detailed and it deals with the Gemara in Chulin. We're going to see in a second that Tosafot actually brings a machloket about what the problem was here. One possibility is that you're shechting within one of those tracheal rings and then you move out into the cartilage between the tracheal rings. So you got the majority inside that tracheal ring. But for the last part of it, you went in between the cartilage between those two tracheal rings. The other possibility is that you're shechting in the tabat ha-gadola, in that large tracheal ring at the top, the Adam's apple, and that shechita then moves, after it's done the robe inside the tabat ha-gadola, it moves outside of the tabat ha-gadola, up to a point that is higher than the area that you're allowed to shech. So over there in the Gemara, it's a machloka between Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda and the Rabbonon, as to whether that's a kosher shechita or not. Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Yehuda believes that as long as the rove was done inside the tabat, it's a shchita kshera. On the other hand, the Chachamim believe that you have to do al pnei kula. The entirety of the shchita has to be within that tabat. And that's a problem of agrama. So this agrama was brought before Rav, and seemingly in a situation in which the rove was done inside of a single tabat. Da'ata the kamei the Rav, tarfe. He made it into a treifa. He said that it's no good, it's an avela. Upatre the tabach min shlumei demei, and then he exempted the butcher from having to pay for the fact that he made it into a treifa. Pagubei Rav Kahana Rav Asi. So Rav Kahana Rav Asi bumped into this individual, Ba'u Gavra. This individual had brought the nevela before Rav. Amrulei Avid Becha Rav Tarte. Rav did two things to you. My Tarte. What does it mean, two things to you? Ilema Tarte li Griuta. He paskin against you on two fronts. The Baile Lachshure Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Yehuda. He should have made it kasher like the shita of Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Yehuda. Bitarfa Kerabonon, and instead he made it into a treifa like the Rabbonon. Vinami Kerabonon, even if you paskin like the Rabbonon, the Baile Lachyuve Latabcha. Even if you paskin like the Rabbonon and it is an Avela, the butcher should be on the hook for that money because he is negligent if he didn't do it properly. Umi shari le meimar ki ay gavna. Are you really permitted to make such a statement? V'hatanya, don't we have a breita? When they exit the Beit Din, lo yomar ani mizakeh v'chaverei mechaybin. I really wanted to paskin in your favor. I really wanted to exonerate you, to remove the liability from you, but what could I do? Aval ma'aseh shechaverai rabu alai, what could I do? I was in the minority. V'azen emar holeich rachil megaleh sod. The gossiper that goes around and discloses things that are a secret. I mean, the Gemara in Sanhedrin says that after a case is concluded, the judges in the case may not disclose their position in the case. The only thing they can disclose is the final position or the final psak. And the assumption is that that final psak is binding on the entire Beit Din, or in essence, it is a unanimous rule of the Beit Din. Because there we take it rubo kukulo. There we discuss this in other places that it's as if the miut doesn't exist, and therefore it becomes a unanimous decision of the Beit Din in this situation. And because of that unanimity, we don't allow dissenting opinions to come out and say we dissented or that we were against this psak halacha. Because that undermines the authority of the psak when people say, well, look, there was another opinion. Maybe that opinion is right. So instead we just give the psak, even though there might be differences or there might have been arguments about what outcome should be, nevertheless, once we've determined what the outcome is, you can't disclose that information, which is very different than the jurisprudence today, where when a case comes before the judges, if there is a dissenting opinion, there's what we call the minority opinion. The minority opinion then is embedded in the majority opinion, because we see a value in that. Not a value in the sense that it's not the majority rules or the court's ruling is not binding, but rather it gives the opportunity for others who review the case then to understand what the others thought. And despite what those others thought, the majority still paskined against that or went against that position. Also, it's something for the future, which is in the future, the courts might see the opinion of the minority writer as becoming the preeminent or predominant way that they want to interpret the situation. That happened to Louis Brandeis, who was a Supreme Court justice who was way ahead of his time. In most cases, he was the minority opinion, the writing minority opinion. Later on, the Supreme Courts and many courts adopted his minority opinions because they saw his view as being more proper or better reading of the situation or the facts. So there is a value in having that minority opinion. The Chachamim were afraid of that undermining the authority of the Beit Din. Again, when the authority of the Beit Din is clear and absolute, then it's less of an issue, even though the halacha doesn't allow disclosure at all. Part of that has to do with there's no appeals. Since we don't appeal cases, so then knowing the minority opinion isn't as important. In today's jurisprudence, where you can appeal the case, the minority opinion might help you because then when you appeal, then the appellate court will then look at the minority opinion as well and say, maybe that's right. So latarte, what do they mean when they said tarte to this guy? Lemalyuta, the Rav Paskin in your favor twice. Delo ochlak safeki surah. He paskin like the Chachamim and not Rabbi Yossi but Rabbi Yehuda, so he didn't give you a safeki surah, because there's a safek as whether the halacha is like the Rabbanan or Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Yehuda, and he paskin the Chumrah like the Rabbanan, so he didn't get any Isser here. Manach misafek gzeilah. And he also prevented you taking money from the tabach, because that's also a safek. Since we don't know what the halacha is with regards to the nevela, if it's really not a nevela, then the tabach doesn't owe the money. So if he obligated the tabach to pay you the money, it's a possibility that you're stealing from the tabach, because the tabach really wasn't obligated, because it was really a kosher shkita. So he saved you from two isurim, isur nevela, and isur of gezel, and so he paskin in your favor in that way. Tosfot over here brings two opinions as to what the issue was. First possibility, according to Rabbeinu Tam, is that Rav really holds like Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Yehuda. Rav paskins like Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Yehuda, the kula, and this was not an nevela. So then why did he paskin for this individual differently? It's because he was an Amaretz. And so even though Rav thought the halacha was right, Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Yehuda, he did not want to be mekil for Amei Aretz, because they may extrapolate whatever he paskins here to a case where it's really not kasher. So since it's a sensitive issue, he paskins the chumrah for them, even though the halacha is not that way. And Tosfot brings other examples where we have a psak halacha specifically because we're afraid of how the Amei Aretz will interpret it, even though the halacha is the kula. So that's the way the Rabbeinu Tam says it, and that's what the Chachamim are saying here in the Tarte, is that he withheld you from a Suffolk Isura because he passed like the Rabbanan, not like Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Yehuda. And again, he prevented you from theft. The Ri, on the other hand, says no, that this case is not about the case of Tabat Agdola, where the Locha is like Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Yehuda, but rather in the other Tabaot. And Rav, over there, doesn't know who the Locha is like. He didn't know if it was like Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Yehuda, or the Chachamim. And therefore, he passed in the Chumrah because of that Safek. So he sees this as being a regular Safek, not Rav getting a protective Pesach to stop people from misinterpreting the Pesach over here. Okay, Itmar. Amare dinar l'shulchani, a person who takes a coin to a money changer to ask him whether this will be going currency. I mean, somebody's trying to pay him. So now when you get paid, sometimes today they use these machines that test whether the currency that you're receiving for payment is real currency. So their equivalent in their day was the Shulchani, a money changer, was an expert in coins. So he went to him to say, will people accept this coin? If I accept this coin as payment, will it be a coin that can be then used? Nimsara. And then in the end, after the Shulchani gave it the A-OK, the person takes the coin and nobody will accept it. So Tani Chada Uman Patur, Hejot Chayav. We have one bright that says if he's an expert, he's Patur. If he's a lay person, he's Chayav. Tanidach ben uman ben idiot chayav. And there's another braita that says, whether you are a layperson or an expert, you are liable for giving bad advice over here. So Amar Rav Papa, kitani uman patur, kagon danku v'isur delot tzrichay, the migmar klau. When we say that the uman is patur, we're talking about super experts like this danko and isur, who don't need to learn anything. I mean, they are the top in the field. Those guys are exempt. Since they are the super experts, they are completely indemnified because there's nothing for them to learn. They can't say, oh, they were mistaken, they should have known more. They know everything. Elamai Tau, if they're such experts, what mistake did they make then? Why was there a mistake? Why was there a problem? Tau besichta hadchadato. Made a mistake with a new peg. Now, a new peg over here doesn't literally mean a new peg, but it means a new minting. There was a new coin or a new minting. Now, whether that new minting either made it that the older minting was no longer valid, or the newer minting they weren't as familiar with, and therefore they gave an opinion, but they weren't fully versed in the new minting because it had just come out. So it's something that was very new, and therefore they didn't have as much experience with it, but they still are the most experienced individuals in this issue. Da'ishata, denafak mitute sikhta, because at that moment, it was being coined. I mean, that the transition was happening at that moment. So since the transition happened at that moment, they weren't yet aware of the fact that the old coin was being taken out of circulation, or they just weren't as familiar with the new coin, and therefore their opinion wasn't as strong. So therefore, that was their mistake. But again, they're indemnified, so that's Uman Zepatur. But any other expert or any layperson would be Chayav because they're getting involved in something where they don't have full knowledge or full expertise, and therefore they become responsible. They're Poshea for giving such an opinion. It's interesting, by the way, that their names are Danko and Isur, which are their names of coins as well. That Danka and an Isar are names of coins, and their names are a play on those coins. So it's interesting, just as an aside. All right, so now Gemara says, "Hai itata de achazia dinar la Rabbi Chia." There was a woman who brought a dinar before Rabbi Chia to opine on its, whether it was a usable currency. Amrla ma'al yahu. He said, it's a good coin, you can accept it, it's a good coin. The machar atai le kamei. The next day she comes before him, v'amarlei achazite, v'amarlei bisho. I went to spend it, I went to use it, and people said it's no good. They won't accept it, and now I can't use the coin. So amarlei the Rav. So Rabbi Chia says to Rav. Rav is Rabbi Chia's nephew, as well as his Talmud. So he's sitting there, he says to Rav, zil chalfe ni'ala, exchange the coin for her, v'katuva pinkasi, dein esek bish. Says, pay her a new coin, replace the coin for her, and then write in my pinkas. My pinkas is like my ledger. Right in there, this was a bad deal. Meaning that Rashi says, because I didn't get paid for this. I just did this for her as a favor. And as a favor, I did this for her, and now I'm out money because I did this favor for her. Umayshna danko v'isur de b'ture. Why are danko and isur indemnified and don't have to pay? Vishim delo tzricha de migmar. Because they didn't have anybody else to learn from. They were the best experts. Rabbi Chia Nami Lav the Migmar Kabai. Rabbi Chia as well is a super expert in coinage. The Gemara doesn't improve this, but it seems that the Gemara take that as granted that Rabbi Chia was an expert in coins, and therefore he should have been exempt over here. Why do you have to pay the woman the money? So Rabbi Chia, Lifnim Mishureta Din Du Avad. Rabbi Chia did not have to pay her back. But he did it, lifnei mishurat hadin. He went beyond the letter of the law, and he paid her back anyway. Kedetani Rav Yosef, as Rav Yosef says, vodata lahem, this is a pasuk by Yitro, when they're setting up the judge system. Over there it says, you will tell them, vodata lahem, what will you make known to them? Ze beit chayehem. That is their house of their livelihood. Rashi over here translates that as Talmud Torah, meaning that the Beit Midrash, or you will teach them the Torah. Whereas Rashi in Baba Metzia translates it as L'lamei lahem umanut li'parnesbo. You have to teach them a profession so that they can earn a living. It's a big difference in the translation. Et haderech, that's the next line in the pasuk. It's vodat lahem et haderech. What's the derech? Zug milut chasadim. That is doing kindness. Yelchu, the way that they should walk. Zubikur cholim. Ba, zukvura, that is bearing. Et ha-maaseh, ze adin. What they should do is the letter of the law. Asher yasun, zo lifni mishurat adin. That is not only the letter of law, but even beyond the letter of the law. So you see here that there is this charge for people not always to do just the letter of the law, but to go beyond the letter of the law and to be good and to do the right thing. And so Rabbi Chiya felt the right thing over here was to pay this woman back, even though he was not obligated to pay this woman back. The Gemara, we're not going to deal with it here, but the Gemara of Metzia asks, isn't Kfura and Bikur Cholim subsets of Gemilut Chasadim? So why do they separate out in the Drasha? We're going to get there in Baba Metzia. We'll discuss it there. In addition, we also discuss in Baba Metzia, Tosafot already raises here, this issue of Lifnim Mishurat Adin. Because Lifnim Mishurat Adin shows up in different cases, and in those different cases, the Gemara brings different psukim to support the fact that you have to do Lifnim Mishurat Adin. Over here, the Rimi Orleans says that Lifnim Mishurat Adin only applies when everybody else would be Chayav and you are Patur. Which is the case here. Anybody else who saw that coin would be responsible to replace it. Rabbi Chiya has an exemption, or he's indemnified because of the fact that he is an expert. Don Kaniser also have that exemption, but that's only because of those unique people or experts, they get the exemption. So the Rimi Orlin says that Lifnim Mishurat Hadin is when everybody else is Chayav and you're Patur, that you make yourself Chayav. You basically make yourself like everyone else. That's called Lifnim Mishurat Hadin. Tosfot over here says the Ein Nira, he rejects that understanding of Lifnim Mishurat Hadin. And he then gives explanations for Lifnim Mishurat Adin and what is classified as Lifnim Mishurat Adin. Tosafot in Baba Metzia actually says that there are three different types of Lifnim Mishurat Adin because the Gemara brings different psukim to support the fact that there is Lifnim Mishurat Adin. One is our pasuk over here. Vodata lahem et haderech yelchu ba et ha-maaseh asher yasun. So that's one possibility. The other possibility is in the Gemara Baba Metzia brings a pasuk which is Leman Teilech B'derech Tovim, to go in the ways of those that are good. And then there's a third thing that the Gemara brings, which is Miot Tov, that when you have a chance to be good and not too bad, you should be good. So all three of those are brought in the Gemara as, quote, Lifnim Mishurat Hadin. And therefore, Tosafot in Baba Metzia breaks those categories down into three different categories and says that there are different types of Lifnim Mishurat Hadin. He uses the Rimi Orleans here as one of those definitions. Sometimes it's a Lifnim Mishurat Hadin, which is where everyone else is Chayav and you're a Patur, and then you opt in to make yourself Chayav. That's one type of Lifnim Mishurat Hadin.
Which comes out of the Pasuk that we quote over here.
Vodata lahem et haderech yelchu ba et ha-maaseh asher yasun. There's another type of Lifnim Mishurat Hadin, which is you're under no obligation to do something, and no one would be under that obligation to do it. And yet, you still do it. That's another type of Lifnim Mishurat Hadin.
Where there's no monetary loss to you, we tell you,
simply Miot Tov, that if you have a chance to do good and not do bad, you would do it or you opt to do that because that is a charge from the Torah. Do good when you have a chance rather than do bad. And then there's a third type of Lifnim Mishurat Hadin, which is the case where, again, nobody else is Chayav to do this. And even in this situation, we wouldn't tell you to go beyond the normal scope and give more latitude to these individuals
because it involves monetary loss to you or some sort of other undertaking or difficulty for you. Nevertheless, there still is a concept of Lifnim Mishurat Hadin, which derives from the pasuk of
Leman Teilech B'derech Tovim. So there he creates these three different levels of Lifnim Mishurat Hadin to deal with the three different sources that the Gemara brings for Lifnim Mishurat Adin. Okay, we're going to stop here. 3 lines down on the top of Kuf Amud Aleph.